So you might have noticed I don't have an altar server today. He's busy. And it's helpful for the priest to once in a while not have things work. Because what happens, like if everything just kind of goes on autopilot, then the result is that all the stuff that's going on behind you, you don't notice it, you don't pay attention to it. And then gradually, if you coast for too long, you take those things for granted, and when things fall, they fall hard. Even though it's a lot to remember, I have to remember the microphone has to go on. I nearly forgot, by the way. I had to come back out and turn it back on. I got to make sure the mass intention is laid out. It's got to all be there. Because although it's great having an altar server who's so competent, as Ta happens to be, if you become over-dependent in certain things, then gradually you lose touch. And the dependence that we need to foster is our dependence on the Savior. The thing we need to stop fostering is dependence on the world. Because the more we rely on the world to provide for the church's needs, to deepen our faith, all of these things, eventually it crumbles, and it crumbles fast. When people tell me that it was a culture's fault that the faith dropped in if people stop attending church overnight, as it happened in certain decades in recent history, it wasn't that decade's fault. It happened before. Usually a sickness or something like that only really manifests after the sickness has taken root for a very long time. So then when it all happens overnight, it's almost because we haven't been paying attention and the whole thing collapses. This is exactly what happened in the 2008 financial crisis. It was financial, social corruption on a massive scale. And then all of a sudden, we had to pay the piper. And the realization was that there was no money, and so all the money disappeared. The same thing happens generally in the spiritual life, where if we build up a foundation too quickly, then sometimes it's God's job to do some pruning. And it feels brutal. It's very unpleasant to undergo. And nobody needs pruning more than the rich, the wealthy, and the powerful. That's why Jesus says in the Gospels that it is easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Notice he doesn't say it's impossible. He just says it's really, really hard and very, very rare. Well, today is one of those rare exceptions. St. Henry II, but he's only the first and the only, and there's a lot of emperors of the Holy Roman Empire. This is modern-day Germany, not actually ancient Rome. This is the 11th century, and so this is the Roman Empire that has its center in the city of Aachen. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it's in the city of Aachen, which is in now modern-day Germany. And he becomes emperor because of a bunch of political machinations, etc. But Henry becomes famous for his asceticism and his care for the church. And both of those things are very important, because both of them supply the necessary checks and balance that we all need in our spiritual life. So first, he was an ascetic, which means that for a man who had, in his time and age, unlimited wealth, he didn't trust wealth. Fasting, penance, almsgiving, all of these things and prayer are all designed to check the will, to prevent us from getting what we want all the time, because if we get what we want all the time, we become, either as children or as adults, spoiled children. And the sad thing is that when a child is spoiled, everything they do is a right. Right? Like if you tell a child that is always getting the best things, that once in a while they have to just eat an apple, they will stomp and stamp their feet and cry and complain and bloody murder. But everyone around them kind of goes, oh, right. Spoiled little brat. Well, that is usually what makes kings go on their downfall, right? There's any number of monarchs in Western European history and in Chinese history and in the history of basically all the way around the world where the wealth gets to the monarch's head and then he starts believing his own propaganda. His own success becomes his downfall. And then gradually the whole thing just disintegrates. The second one is unchecked political power. And one of the great legacies of medieval Christianity that is strangely not attributed to the Middle Ages is the distinction between ecclesiastical and temporal power. Any one of us do not like having moral checks, let alone financial checks on our lives. And so if we have the ability to have a supreme authority in the temporal sphere, then we naturally have the temptation throughout all of human history to say that temporal power has spiritual power, that a king is a religious figure. Western Christianity, from its development, said that is not true. That a king is a king and a bishop is a bishop, and they are not the same thing. And that they check each other. A bishop should be financially, in a sense, destitute, so he has to rely on the people in order for him to actually fulfill his mission, but that the people require the bishop for the sacraments and this kind of moral movement, because you never trust a rich man to have a clear conscience. Both of these principles were embedded in the Christian mindset of the Middle Ages, where the bishop and the king were kept separate, and Henry knew this. So he became a huge supporter in terms of endowments of land and everything, of church autonomy, from his political rule. Now, mind you, in some ways it was to his political benefit, but generally speaking, it's a very important reality that civil society and the church society are mutually porous, they interpenetrate with each other, but that they are independent enough so that when one gets too big for its britches, the other one can say, watch out. And God uses both. It would be very naive to read all of history and then to say, well, because the bishops did it or because the Pope did it, it must be God's will. It would be incredibly naive to do that. On so many levels. And today we have the opposite reaction, where we think that if something's done by a civil society or by some kind of activist against the church, then they obviously must be right, which is also nuts. We have to have a much more fundamental allegiance to the truth himself, to Christ, which means that we would have no compromise with lies, deceptions, willful destruction of the poor, any outright and dedicated committing of evil must be off the table. And sometimes it will be civil society that provides the impetus, and sometimes it will be the church that provides it. And by that I mean the visible institutional element of the church. We're all a part of the church. But there's also the third one. Your enemies might provide you with especially clear insight. You notice that in today's first reading, that the prophet Isaiah refers to the king of Assyria as the rod of his anger. Later on, when the Babylonians conquer and defeat the Jewish people, the Babylonian kingdom becomes, in a sense, a vessel of God's judgment of his own people. And then eventually, when the Persians defeat the Babylonians, then King Cyrus becomes called a Messiah by Jewish literature, as a savior figure. That God does work his, I'm going to say magic, but he works his stuff through anything, any possible venue. And so the logic of us versus them can never apply to an authentic Christian conscience. Always be surprised as to how God sanctifies you. He might sanctify you through an ecstatic religious experience. He might sanctify you as you're lying on the cancer bed. He might sanctify you through a growing parish. He might be sanctifying the parish by making it smaller. Never just assume because the good times are rolling that God's will is being done. Or never just assume because bad things are happening that God's will is being done. Use the reason. What did Jesus say? Am I doing it? And it's really funny. When you talk to political type people, everything they say is ridiculously complicated. You ask them, what should we do right here? And then, you know, they'll gather together like CBC does. Well, we've got three experts and they all have their opinions, and then they kind of ramble on for a while. Or you can just say, what's the right thing to do? Are people not having homes because they're too expensive? Fix it. Is money becoming problematic because people can't afford a food for their families? Yeah. Then fix it. Oh, but it might mess up our economic system. Then mess up the economic system. Our church is needing to change and to grow and to be able to welcome new people. Yes, but we don't want to stop doing this. Is this preventing you from doing the right thing? Yes. Then change that. This is why Jesus, when he says to us, be like children, that he's hidden these things from the wise and the learned. The reason being, as I learned from my captivity in academia when I had to study, and then I had to read academic journals and all this other stuff, they never asked the simple question, what's the right thing to do? What is the truth in this matter? What is the good thing? What is truly beautiful? They always make recourse, not always, I don't want to sound too parochial, but generally the tendency is to say, what's the ongoing development of the spirit of the age, or some nonsensical question, to which there is no answer. Be like children. And we'll find that like King Henry, or King St. Louis, or all the different monastics that helped renew Europe, or all of the different beautiful women that came to Canada to do the right thing and help form a beautiful society, but not without its limits. They didn't think like politicians. They thought like Christians. They did the best they could, and they entrusted everything, even their failures, to the mercy of God.